Welcome, friends, to another Lance Howard podcast episode. Today, I am going to bring you a great conversation with my guest, Mark Miller. These conversations are designed to help you multiply your leadership potential by strengthening your stewardship. And today, Mark Miller and I dive in together about what this looks like as he shares wisdom from a 40 plus year at Chick-fil-A. Currently, he is on his last lap as a vice president of high performance leadership at Chick-fil-A. His latest book number 25, I might add, is Cultural Rules, The Leader's Guide to Creating the Ultimate Competitive Advantage. Tune in today to hear more about how Mark shares about life, his marriage, raising kids, leadership at Chick-fil-A, what he would want Truett Cathy to say as he finishes his last lap at Chick-fil-A, and what is most important to Mark Miller right now in his leadership as he considers everything that God has entrusted to his care and ultimately how he makes a greater impact. If I can help serve you in any way, or if you'd like to be featured as a guest on the podcast in a coaching conversation, I'd be honored to have you. You can find me at lancehoward.com. Now, without further ado, here is our conversation. One of the pressing questions that I have for you this morning, right? We know your long tenure at Chick-fil-A. We know that you're a high performance coach, and you've written countless books, sold millions. And your latest book is about culture. But I want to talk about the culture of your life, and more specifically, the culture of you and your marriage relationship with Donna. Because if I believe, you're coming up on 41 years next month. I would love to start there.
Okay. So Donna and I met in high school. I tell the story. I had transferred in to a new school my junior year in high school, and they had made an egregious error and placed me in trigonometry. But I didn't have the wherewithal to raise my hand. I just knew I was in trouble on day one, but just kind of went along with the flow, right? I'm there and trying to pay attention and do what I can, and got the first test paper back and looked at it, and I thought, okay. Well, at least now I've got something to talk to this cute girl about, because I had not spoken to Donna up until that moment. And so I said to her, hey, how'd you do on the test? And she said, pretty good. And I said, what'd you make? And she said, 96. She said, what'd you make? And I said, a 16. And she said, how do you make a 16? And I said, I think they gave me points for getting my name right. And so that was our first recorded conversation. I tell people that she took pity on me. That would have been, gosh, how long ago was that? That was 46, 47, 48 years ago.
Wow.
And so that was our first conversation, and we're still together all these years later. And by the way, she manages the finances and the checkbook. So just know that some things have not changed in all these years.
That's great. That's great. You lost me at trigonometry. That's indeed.
Yes.
And apparently they lost you as well. So
absolutely. They did lose me, but I stuck it out and got through it.
That's good. That's good. So what has sustained your marriage through all the storms, all the ups, all the downs, the mountains and valleys? What is the thing or two that you would point back to that builds a successful marriage?
Wow. Okay. I mean, you probably should know that answer better than I, but I'll give it a shot. I think the bedrock has been our faith, is that we have a common faith, which has enabled us to endure those hard times. I'll say another factor for us is that we have two sons, Justin and David, and David is disabled. And the statistics for marriages where there's a disabled child are staggeringly disappointing. And I haven't seen any recently, but the last I heard, the divorce rate is well over 80%. And I would argue that in our case, it strengthened our marriage because we needed each other to get through and still getting through having a severely handicapped son. It's been a great blessing in many, many ways, but it created a lot of trial and a lot of hardship and a lot of angst and anguish and uncertainty. Some of that continues to this day. And so I think David's situation actually drew us closer together because I cannot imagine. I mean, I'm not judging people who've chosen a different path. I could not imagine raising David alone. It took all we could do to do it together.
Yeah.
And so I think for in our special case, that was another factor beyond our faith. We were further united in the common cause of taking care of David and raising him.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the heart of what I'm pursuing as we continue to talk, right? You've written numerous books for leaders, right? The latest one about culture. But I think too often of times we're missing the heartbeat of everything that you've just described. Like, right, like we can build a phenomenal organization, but at the root of it, if I may, like your success is in large part of like how you have built your life and the struggles that has sustained you through these sure. years. Because we live in a culture of the leadership of the quick fix. Right. And, mm-hmm. and abandon all theory and practices if it's not working.
Right.
I want to come back to David. One last question for you and Donna. What was the last date that you took Donna on? And what does that say about your leadership?
Yeah, that's a really thoughtful question. It might hinge on how you define date, and I'm not playing with you here. I mean, we just spent 6 days with the grandkids on a Disney cruise. Now, she might not qualify that as a date, but it was probably the most fun she's had in a long time. And so I want a little bit of credit for like making all that happen. Yeah. So let me answer your question more directly. I'm trying to be sure that we spend some time together every week. And often that does include other family members. Even Sunday, we got together as a family and with my sons. Well, in fact, David was not with us for Sunday, but my other son and his wife and her brother and the grandkids, and we intentionally, even though we just come off a week of a cruise, we got back Friday night, but we're back together on Sunday. So we have always, even when my parents were alive, we put a high premium on that family time together, which again is probably doesn't qualify as a date. A lot of those are just with Donna, but we've tried to raise the value and practice of family my entire life. And again, now that my parents are gone, I've kind of assumed that role of being sure that we continue to do that. So I don't know the last part of your question of what does it say about my leadership? I need to continue to be intentional there. I think, as you mentioned, more than 40 years in, I could take that relationship for granted, and I don't need to do that. I don't intend to do that. So trying to spend a lot of one-on-one time with her.
Yeah.
And have tried to do that. I would even argue trying to do more of that now that the kids are out of the house. And now I say that David's still with us a couple days a week. We have a home for him. He has live-in caregivers, but he's with us 2 days a week. And so we're trying to honor each other and family. And that's kind of been a theme for us for many years.
That's good. That's good. How do we grow up in our seasons of suffering? And in your case, I'm even thinking about my own very close friend who's possibly listening to this post-recording, who has a disabled son. That is a unique perspective that you and your family have. But how do you grow up through that? And what is God trying to grow you up in that process and that journey as well?
Yeah. So obviously these are fantastic questions. I don't even know that I have answers to do justice to the magnitude of that question. I prayed. Now, David is, how old is David? David is 33. So I've been praying for decades for God to teach me what he wants me to learn. Help me see the things that I'm supposed to learn on this journey. And that's been my prayer really from the very beginning, when we realized that there were challenges and there were issues with David. I think one of the things that has become clearer to me day after day, week after week, year after year, is David reminds me of God's unconditional love for me, because our love for David is unconditional. David's not going to tell us he loves us. He can't even talk, right? I mean, not in this lifetime. He's not even going to talk. But we love him anyway. It's not because of what he does that we love him. And so he is a constant reminder of God's unconditional love.
Yeah. How do you wish people would see you and understand and love your serve your family in light of David, in light of y'all's raising your son?
Yeah. Well, we are very fortunate that we've been surrounded by a community of people that love David. And so I have no further wish that the people that know and love us know and love David, and we couldn't ask for anything more.
Yeah. Yeah. Really just to see it as integrated, that there's no difference. And I think sometimes we on the outside perceive that there is this difference, right? Because unfortunately we have normals, whatever norm is, and we define what norm is, and then we don't know how to interact with our perception of normal. So I think at least what I'm hearing is just integrate you and your family and David and those listening, just as part of life.
We tell people David marches to a different drummer. We just try to hear the beat.
I think I love one of the things I'm fascinated about high capacity leaders like yourself. And I picked up on some of this with you and David on Instagram, at least, is that you have an adventurous spirit, and y'all have done a lot of challenges together, running together. Would you share more about that and maybe the genesis of how some of that even started?
Okay. Well, yes. And I follow your question. I will say that most of the adventures that you see me post about are with my older son. Okay. Now, David and I have done a few things, but David is very limited. Cognitively, David is between 12 and 18 months. Right. So,
but haven't you ran a few races with him?
And he loves a boat ride, and we've done a couple of the races where he's in the stroller. Right. And so we do some of that, but the real adventure stuff, my older son and I have tried as much as possible every year to do something that will stretch us. And he came up with a crazy idea a few years back that we would run a marathon. And I said, okay. I mean, I'd never run to the mailbox, but you know, we ran our marathon, and one year it was, let's become certified scuba divers. And, you know, I don't really like water, but we did that. We've been to Everest Base Camp, and we've been to 2 years ago, Mount Kenya. The year before that, we climbed Mount Rainier. So it's not always climbing, but as referenced by the scuba and the water. But more recently, we've been doing climbs together. So we're just trying to stretch ourselves. We're trying to challenge ourselves. I think you grow when you do hard things. And yeah. So we started that years ago with my older son. And with David, we're always looking for, we tried taking him skiing. There are things called sit skis that disabled people can sit in, and somebody's behind them with a tether. And we tried that several times, and with mixed to negative responses from David. And we said, well, we're not trying to torture the kid. And so we've right. not done that in recent right. years. He does love a boat ride. So yeah. we bought a boat. So we can, he loves the, I think it's the combination of the wind and the water. Nice. So boat riding is probably David's favorite adventure sport.
That's good. That's good. What have you experienced from all the numerous leaders that you've been around of why they sabotage themselves, and their physical health in particular? Right. We get busy and we load our schedule up, and the next thing you know, we're a decade in. And many leaders are just not in the physical shape that God has really entrusted to their care.
Yeah, I'm probably not qualified to talk about that. I fall into that trap myself. My coach has named it for me. I don't know if you would agree. I know you coach a lot of leaders. He said, my fundamental problem is that I have an event mentality versus a process mentality. And so I'll put a marathon on the calendar and figure out, okay, I need 16 weeks to get ready. And so 16 weeks before the marathon, I'll get ready for the marathon. And so he has reached the conclusion, I'll put this on my coach, that I'm probably not going to change my event mentality. So his encouragement is just to put a lot of events on the calendar so that I'll stay in shape. You know, I've had mixed success with that strategy. You know, I think leaders, to the root of your question, again, I don't know. You've had psychological training, and I have not. It's probably unique depending on who you're talking to as to the real root cause for that. Sometimes I think it's short-sightedness. Sometimes I think it's hubris, or, you know, a sense of invincibility, which of course is always misplaced. Yeah. Again, a lack of discipline, a lack of prioritization. I'm in a season right now where I'm not doing the things that I need to do to maintain my peak level of fitness. And I would probably give you a dozen reasons, but at this moment, it has fallen from the top of my priority list, which again, I know is crazy and it's short-sighted, and I feel bad that I'm having to confess to you, but I will recover. Right. And it may be because my son and I will say, we're going to run a marathon in September, and I'll go, okay, I've got to change my priorities because I've got this event coming. I would love to cultivate the ability to stay in peak fitness. And that's just something that has been very elusive for me.
Interesting.
You need to coach me on that, because I know you're an athlete. I'd love some coaching on that.
Yeah. Well, I think for myself, and I hear this in your story, like where I found integration is just with my family. Like, right. I love working out. But the integration, thinking the long term of my girls and I doing Spartan races in a decade from now, right? So like your values, clearly family, and the integration is like, oh, how do I continue to do this with my sons, you know, and honestly not beat yourself up over it and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I just wanted to be honest with you and your audience that this is an area that I'm hit or miss. I'll be in great shape and not great shape, and great shape and not great shape. Yeah. And, you know, climb mountains and run marathons. And we're looking at future climbs. And yeah. I mean, I'm an old man, and I'm still we're looking at a 23,000 foot peak as one of right. our next challenges. That's yeah. great. Yeah. I'll have to get in shape for that. Right. So maybe as I enter the next chapter of my life, I say maybe one of my personal goals is to attack that, because I'm approaching a transition out of my chicken right. career. And I'm going to give a real good effort at getting in the kind of shape you're in and right. staying there.
Right, right. I think that's the heart of the question, right? So many men lose the spirit of dreams and desires, like, right, like work is a season, and God has called us to work. But the reality is that it's okay to have dreams and desires and ambitions and to chase those. Because there's so many men who like are retirement season on the last lap, like you are, who don't really know what's next. But I just hear this yearning for dreams that are out there that you're going to still chase.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I'm not a fan of retirement. Here's my cut. And again, I want to be respectful to the hundreds of millions of people who have retired. I think you can retire from a job. I don't think you can retire from a calling. Mm. Like, the calling transcends where your paycheck's coming from. Yeah. And I think a calling transcends season of life. My next challenge is I want to try to figure out how to serve 100 million leaders in the next decade. And so that's I don't think that's retirement. I think it means I'm not going to come to the Chick-fil-A headquarters several days a week. But I'm going to, the pace of the game is going to quicken for me yeah. in this next phase.
Interesting. Well, so let's talk about the last lap that you're on.
Okay.
I mean, you've had a phenomenal career. And I'm just reflecting back on all the numerous stories that you probably have about Truett, the numerous stories that you've grown up in the process. What are one or two of the nuggets that are keep coming to the surface as you kind of make this last lap? Because there's probably something that keeps surfacing right now.
Well, for me, it's a thankful heart. And I would say I've pretty much had a thankful heart for the whole ride, because it's been a crazy, unpredictable ride. I have served at the pleasure of the organization. I've been on staff more than 40 years. Truett hired me. I was the 16th employee here. And I've worked all across the business. Several of those were career changes where you would say, oh, well, you went from leading the training group to starting the quality team or working in restaurant. I mean, those are different, like, those aren't the same. It's not like moving up from one level in accounting to another level in accounting. I'm learning new stuff. And so I think my last lap, as many of the previous laps, have been with a very, very thankful heart that I've had the opportunity to learn and to grow and to have, you know, have an impact on other leaders. I'm very thankful that Chick-fil-A, 25 years ago, when Ken Blanchard and I, it was my first book. We partnered together to write a book. And Ken was the one with the idea. Some of your audience may not know Ken, but a thought leader in the leadership space. He's the only guy, I think, to this day, who ever had three books on the New York Times bestseller list at one time.
Wow. Yeah.
And so he approached me about writing a book about 25 years ago, and I went to Chick-fil-A and I said, Ken Blanchard's got this crazy idea, and I'd never written a book, never even thought about writing a book. And our executive committee debated it for a while, and they said, why don't you do that? Maybe it will serve the world. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a moment of, I mean, if you want to think about an abundance mentality. Now, none of us knew that first book is called The Secret. Right. It's in 25 languages. It has served the world. Yeah. And so this last lap to me is just a heightened level of thankfulness that I've had an opportunity to do the things that I've done over the years.
Yeah. That's just boggling, right? Like when you think about the magnitude of that impact. What would you desire Truett to say to you in these last days at Chick-fil-A? Like if you could hear his voice right now, what would you want to hear?
That he was glad he hired me. Because it was weird. I had worked in a restaurant as a team member. I was a teenager at the time, and I was awful in the restaurant. I mean, I was awful. I won't even go into it. I was awful. I was so bad, I knew that I was going to be fired at any moment. So I made what I call a strategic career decision, and I quit because I thought it would be easier to explain me just leaving than having to explain for the rest of my life how I got fired at Chick-fil-A. So I went and I got another job. And about 6 months later, I got laid off of my new job. And I thought, man, I need a job. And I said, I can't do what they do in the restaurants. Maybe I could work at the Chick-fil-A corporate headquarters, which of course makes no sense at any level, but this was the mind of a child, right? So I walked into the headquarters and told the receptionist I wanted a job working in the warehouse. So she told me to have a seat. Just a few minutes later, Truett came out, got me, took me into his office to conduct the interview, which didn't make sense. But I learned that I was trying to become the 16th corporate employee. So if you've only got 15 employees, the head man or the head woman is probably making the decision, right? And so I tell people it was a combination of God's grace and lack of discernment on Truett's part that he gave me that job in the warehouse.
Wow. Wow.
And so I hope that all these years later, he would be glad he hired me.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. So how many years exactly? I know it's 40 plus.
Well, that was in 1978. So this would be 44 years. Is that right?
Okay. So in our, I've referenced it, in our age of the leadership of the quick fix, whatever it is, right? An organization, team, culture, your marriage, whatever. Like, what is your discernment for people that are trying to figure out how do they stay the long game of something 40 years, which is really going to be an unheard of in 40 years from today? Because there's a huge tree that you've grown, right? And all these beautiful acorns that are falling off of it now at this point. But how do you encourage people to stay where they're planted and all those things? And how do you help somebody to discern like when it's time to go?
Wow. Okay. So here's my overarching counsel, and then I'll try to speak to the specifics. Somebody asked me, it wasn't too awful long ago, they said, was there a defining moment? Like, because it's a hard story to even wrap your head around. I mean, started in the warehouse, couldn't do what they do in the restaurant, started in the warehouse, and here we are more than 40 years later. And the essence of the question was there a defining moment? And I said, well, for me, there actually was, and it was over 40 years ago. And it was when it was explained to me that my capacity to grow would determine my capacity to lead. And I went, well, let me think about that. My capacity to grow is going to impact my capacity to lead. It's going to determine my capacity to lead. If I want more influence, if I want more opportunity, if I want more impact, there's only one path. It's personal growth. And so I made that decision. Now, I'm telling this story to somebody, and they said, well, that's probably easy for you. And I said, well, why would you say that? And they said, well, you're probably a learner, which would be a reference to the strength finders, the 32, 34, one of those like innate things that some people have is they're a learner. And I said, you know what? I said, learner's not in my top five. it's not in my top 10. I'm not sure it's in my top 25. And they said, well, that's odd. And I said, well, why is that odd? And they said, well, you act like a learner. And I said, well, thank you. I made that decision about 43 years ago. And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, I'd rather listen to the radio driving to work, but I'm probably going to listen to a book on tape or a podcast. Because if, in fact, you believe that your capacity to grow determines your capacity to lead, and I want more influence, I want more opportunity, I want more impact, then I'm going to make this strategic choice. And it's a choice you have to make every day. And so I don't even encourage people to stay for the long haul. I encourage people to learn throughout their lifetime. Oh. And I think the second part of that is try to add value to every person you encounter. Now, there are some people hearing that. They're going to go, well, that's impossible. Well, hold time out. I know. Time out. Listen, you got to listen real carefully to what I'm asking you to consider. Try to add value to every person you encounter. So it's the effort that changes you, right? It's the orientation. Because I'm no longer thinking about me if I'm trying to add value to you.
Right.
And you'll end up adding a lot more value. Well, what happens when you add value? That further expands your opportunity for influence. Oh. Right. So they kind of go hand in hand. So if you're adding value and learning and growing, I think you'll have a lot of opportunities within your existing organization. And I don't really have advice on when to stay and when to go. I think that's there are too many variables, there are too many circumstances. Yeah. But if you're learning and adding value, I don't think your current place of employment will want you to go.
Right.
I think they'll want you to stay.
Well, and I'm gonna transition to stewardship, but as I think and hear what you're saying, like you're just being a faithful steward of what God has given you. And whatever the outcome of that is, we've got to let go of that control. But if I really believe that I'm entrusted with gifts and talents and resources, then I have a responsibility upon my life, right? I had Steve Robinson on the podcast last summer, I believe, and I know it's embedded in y'all's DNA, this idea about stewardship. Could you share like how that DNA for people early on at Chick-fil-A was built and what stewardship really means to you right now in this season?
Well, it actually may link back to your previous question is, how do you know if it's time to go? Even though I said I don't have advice on that, I think you've got to check for alignment between your values and the values of your organization. And I'm not saying they even have to be perfectly aligned, but misalignment is going to make it hard. Misalignment would make it very, very hard, which is why I think I and many, many others have enjoyed a long career at Chick-fil-A, because there are a lot of people around here who are attracted by the aspiration to be good stewards. I believe I've got three primary roles in life: steward, servant, and student. And steward is my first role. And so when I find an organization that has stewardship at the heart and core of its purpose, it's like, yeah, that's, I can get behind that. Now, I'll quickly say, and I know you encounter this given, I know a little bit about what you do and how you approach coaching and leadership. I think stewardship is greatly misunderstood. And I think most people define it far too narrowly. I have what I would consider the broadest definition. It's about opportunities. It's about relationships. It's about resources. It's about time. It's about, it's about, because we don't own any of it, right? We are stewards of all of it. And so I think there are a lot of people around here who believe that, which I think helps strengthen our culture because we're aligned around that shared aspiration to be good stewards.
Yeah, yeah. So much of our anxiety could be resolved, I think, once we let go of this idea that we don't own anything.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Stewards of it all.
Yeah. Just a couple more thoughts as we kind of bring our conversation to close in the next several minutes. How do you know when you're out of alignment with your walk with God? And like, what do you do to get back in alignment?
Okay. Some of your audience will know the name John Ortberg. Mm-hmm. John, former teaching pastor at Willow Creek, former senior pastor at Menlo Park out on the West Coast. He has been a friend and mentor for me for many, many years. And he challenged me, not me personally, I mean, he's challenged a lot of people with this idea that what you really want is a well-ordered heart. And the test that he has challenged me with is, am I growing in love for God and love for people? And if I'm not growing in love for God and love for people, something's out of whack. Call it what you will. Call it misalignment. Call it out of sync. Call it priorities or askew. But that is the test that I think we can find rooted in Scripture. Are you growing in love for God and love for people? And I just try to ask myself that question a lot. And when the answer is no, I say, okay, why not? And what do I need to do about it? So to me, it's a process of constant assessment and adjustments, And when I'm living at my highest level, it's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's kind of my short answer, and with all credit to John for helping me frame it that way.
Yeah. Keep it simple.
I like simple. We sell chicken, right? Let's keep it simple.
Right. That's good. So Mark, I know I've got your latest book here, The Culture Rules: Leader's Guide to Creating the Ultimate Competitive Advantage. And I know your heart is already moving to the next thing. I'll let you kind of go where you want to go with this question. What is important right now to you as you consider leadership, vocation, and the kind of the next thing you're working on?
I'm still trying to figure out how to encourage and equip leaders in my next season. Chick-fil-A has provided a wonderful platform. So thankful. Not just a platform, the resources, the encouragement, the mandate to create the things that we've created over the years, including the book you just read. So thankful for all of that. In this next season, I want to not only continue, but as I mentioned earlier, I want to take that to another level. I want to serve tens of millions. And I have friends that are challenging me that number is way too low. And it may be in today's world. I mean, I set that number a few years back, but now I heard, you know, some of your listeners will know the name Lewis Howes. He has the School of Greatness. Mm-hmm. He's now reaching 100 million people a week. So maybe my 100 million is too low. So for my team that has said, hey, that's not near big enough, I said, well, let's start there. Let's call that a milestone, right? I mean, Mr. Beast has just set a goal to be the first YouTuber with 1 billion subscribers, with a B.
Yeah.
So who knows? If we have this conversation again in 24, 36 months, I may tell you, yeah, we're shooting for something far beyond that. So what's on my heart right now is, back to stewardship. How do I steward the content, the influence, the things that have been entrusted to me in the next season, because there'll certainly be some things I've lost by leaving Chick-fil-A, but there'll be some things I've gained because I couldn't go on the speaking circuit for the last 40 years. I kind of had a day job and whatever. So I want to add more value in the next decade than I have in the last 10 years. Add more in the next decade than I have in the last decade. Yeah. So that's what's on my heart right now.
Yeah. Why do you believe that's important to you right now?
Wow, what a great question. To me, it's a sense of stewardship. And I go to the parable of the talents. Not the parable of the talents, the parable of the sower. It's like we don't control the harvest.
Right.
I think that a lot of leaders have to come to grips. We do not control the harvest, but we do control how much seed we throw. I think it's a numbers game. If I want to serve the maximum number of leaders in my lifetime, right? When David had fulfilled his purposes in his generation, then he died, right? I want to serve as many leaders as God wants me to serve. Well, the only way to test that is to serve more, you know, to throw more seed.
Right.
And then I don't control the harvest, but I want to throw more seed. And so to me, it's actually driven by a sense of stewardship. I've got the seed. How do I throw it?
How do you tether such a large impact to being close to a few, right? Because we can reach the masses in mm-hmm. today's culture at the expense of our heart. And I see that, right, locally, globally. So how do you tether this mass reach to actually being tethered to what is most important? Because for me, the one reason for the question is like, I'm trying to discern, like, what is my walk with social media? Because I'm like, I'm trying to get away from it, but yet, you know, you can leverage it for so much good. And I know you probably have a team around you too, but how do you write, like, it's the both and I know that can coexist, but how do you tether yourself to what's most important?
Okay. Well, I heard three or four things there. So I think what you're describing is what Jim Collins calls the genius of the and. When leaders and organizations find a way to embrace two or more things that at times are at odds, they release tremendous power. There's energy in that friction. There's energy in that tension. When Toyota said, we're going to create the highest quality cars in the world at a low price, it's like, well, no, those don't work together. Well, they made a pretty good business out of saying we're going to do high quality at low cost, right? We talk about valuing results and relationships as a leader. Well, no, is it one or the other? Well, no, the best leaders, they do both. They manage that tension. They don't resolve the tension. They manage it. So my posture on your question is I want to manage the tension, because to forego either one is the wrong answer. To forego reach for community or to forego community for reach, I think the internet and social media is the most powerful leadership tool in the history of the world. I did a post recently on leadership character, a minute and 40 seconds. And it's about the heart of a leader. It's about the heart of a servant leader. As of yesterday, it's been seen by 498,000 people. Yeah. Culture Rules may not sell 498,000 copies. And I can guarantee you 498,000 people aren't going to read it if they did buy it. So I can't walk away from that, but I understand the priority and preeminence of community in somebody's life. So I think you have to, that would be a great example to me of the genius of the and. So how do I navigate that? Imperfectly, but I think you put mechanisms in place. So I started a group 25 years ago, and we meet twice a month for 3 hours, and there are 10 guys in that group. We're 25 years in. Six, I guess, of the 10 were original guys from the group 25 years ago. That's a mechanism, and it's on my calendar every 2 weeks for the rest of the year. And at some point mid-year, we'll probably publish the dates for next year. And as much as possible, we all schedule our life around those meetings. And I leave either on a 11 o'clock flight on Monday nights or on a 6 a.m. flight Tuesday morning, whenever possible, so I can be at those meetings. So that'd just be a mechanism. I think you've got to understand the tension, right? And you suboptimize your impact if you forego either one. Same with results in relationships. The best way to depress results is to focus exclusively on results. The second best way to depress results is to focus exclusively on relationships. You need both. You need both. It's the genius of the and.
I love that. That's so helpful. So possibly two questions, and we'll close together. What is God's heart right now towards the things that he's entrusted to you?
I think anytime God wanted to do something of significance in the world, he called a leader. He appointed a leader. I think everything rises and falls on leadership. Homes, schools, churches, armies, even chicken restaurants. Everything rises and falls on leadership. I think leadership is a God-ordained responsibility, even in a secular world. I think it's not secular nor sacred, right? But it is God-ordained. It's God-created. And I think when a leader grows, increases their efficacy and their impact, everybody wins. So I think that's God's heart on leadership.
Helping people win, believing in the best in people, bringing out their God-given best as well. So smart leadership, culture rules, two of your recent works, two principles that I am thankful for and I think are missing is this aspect of listening and asking questions and smart leadership. You even have a section in there about it. Culture rules, you talk about how Toyota listens. So for me, that's what's missing in leadership today. But if you could just kind of close on your own personal wisdom of like, hey, focus on this.
Well, yeah. Again, great, great question. If you're going to lead well, you have to be grounded in reality, which is the first smart choice from smart leadership. And the more we do research, and I would say globally, we just finished another global study. This one's on organizational change, which would be the 26th book. And leaders appear in study after study to be out of touch, often by as much as 40 points.
Wow.
So you say, is your organization a great place to work? Leaders are going to say it's about 80%, and the frontline people are going to say it's about 40%. Was this change successful? There's going to be about a 40-point gap. Do you love your job? There's about a 40-point, so I think part of that solution, a huge part of closing that gap, is for leaders to listen more intentionally, more strategically, more proactively. I think if they're not listening, they have tied both hands behind their backs. I mean, the conventional wisdom, this is another topic for another day, but conventional wisdom is about 70% of organizational change efforts fail. What kind of stewardship is that? You think about what's involved in the time, energy, effort, money to have 70% failure rate. And I actually think it could be higher, but that's the kind of the conventional wisdom. I would say the predominant factor is lack of dynamic awareness on the part of the leader. They just don't know what's going on, really, as it relates in that example, as it relates to the change. They cast a vision, they delegated something to somebody, and they expect it to happen. Yeah. It just doesn't work that way, right? So I think there is a mounting body of evidence that, to your point, what's missing is leaders are not listening enough. As Howard Behar said, they're not having enough of those one-on-one conversations. Yeah. Now, the root cause behind that, we're trying to get at that ourselves. This last study, or the next one of our recent studies, the number one barrier to leadership effectiveness is ego. We got data on that. Well, that might be the reason they're not listening, because they don't think they need to listen. So it's going to be a hard nut to crack, but we're going to try to chip away at it. That's the best good. Leaders are listeners. Yeah.
Super, super helpful. I have about five more questions because of that, but I am indebted to you for your time. I'm honored by you today. I know you have a full life, so thank you. I know how to find you, but could you briefly share how others could find you?
Well, the first thing I'll say is my cell number is 678-612-8441. So if you've got questions, call me or text me, and I'll be happy to try and respond to those. Also, we have a site called Lead Every Day, which right now is focused primarily on the book, but there's more coming there. And we've got all the old resources and field guides and all that stuff there for people. We've now created field guides for 10 of the 12 books. So we've got lots of resources there. So I hope that would serve some in your audience.
As I consider the three things that I find helpful for Mark and I's conversation, I like the three principles of what he says he tries to focus on every day. Being a good steward, serving others, and being a student. Steward, service, and student. What for you was helpful in our conversation? I'd love to hear from you. Even take a few moments to like, subscribe, and share this if you find this content and coaching conversations helpful. Where do you need to be a steward? Who can you serve? And how can you be a student and learn from someone today? Please like, subscribe, and share this. And if you would like to be featured on the Lance Howard podcast, I'd love to hear from you. Go to lancehoward.com and let me know how I can best serve you in a real-time coaching conversation that we can share with the world. Peace and courage to you on your stewardship journey. And I hope that God will allow you to multiply everything that He has entrusted to your care.